The emergence of the U.S. debt and credit industrial complex. As the relative importance and profitability of U.S. manufacturing and finance exchanged positions, a larger national transformation took place, akin to the upheaval in the 1880s and 1890s as railroading and manufacturing jumped ahead of agriculture in value added to the U.S. economy. In those days of agrarian despair, debt played a prominent role. It always seems to, in ruining overextended elements of the declining farm population while leveraging the ascent of the emerging industrial sector. Debt also has a well-known history of causing bubbles and periodic crises. By Bush's second term, the debt problem that had agitated the late 1980s and early 1990s had reasserted itself. The 1997 to 2001 return of budget surpluses became a mirage. Pessimists refocused their analyses on the long-term debt expansion arising out of the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. A graph for the 1965 to 2005 period of the critical debt measurements, public and private, domestic and international, would uncage a half-dozen climbing snakes, raising their heads for some sort of fiscal strike. The data are apples and oranges, but the problems are unmistakable. The accelerating displacement of U.S. manufacturing by the financial services sector, as we have seen, goes far back, greatly antedating both the late 1990s stock market bubble and the terrorist strikes of September 11, 2001. Since those events, however, the evolution from physical production into debt craft has accelerated alongside Washington's resort to massive stimulus of consumer borrowing and home refinancing. Debt and spending became fiscal patriotism, a way to strike back at Al-Qaeda by supporting the U.S. economy in the automobile showrooms, mortgage offices, and shopping malls. Just before the 2004 election, columnist Daniel Gross caught the new spirit of this rate-cut Keynesianism. The message since the September 11th attacks has been a strange and occasionally dissonant message of patriotism and consumption. As New Yorkers flocked to Ground Zero to volunteer, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani exhorted Gothamites to patronize Tribeca restaurants. President Bush appeared in ads urging Americans to fly and stay in hotels. These days, it seems, they also serve who spend like there's no tomorrow. Whereas during both world wars, government posters beseeched Americans to save and buy U.S. bonds, now the media relayed a different wartime imperative. Uncle Sam wants you to borrow. Taking advantage of zero-rate auto loans or refinancing your house was joining the nation's response to terror. Never before have political leaders urged such large-scale indebtedness on American consumers to rally the economy. Debt has not previously been held out as a solution to a nation already overburdened by it, especially one vulnerable to restive global creditors. Moreover, it is difficult to believe that the rise of finance, the relative decline of manufacturing, and the polarization of incomes and wealth in the United States can be reversed if political control continues to pass to rentiers and credit vendors. Think on the differences between the two sectors in income distribution. In the heyday of manufacturing, from the 1920s to the early 1970s, wave after wave of unionized blue-collar jobs lifted tens of millions of Americans into the middle class. Today, the American financial services economy pushes in the opposite direction. Its narrowing employment base, some 8 million in 2004 out of a national workforce of 131 million, contrasted to the much broader uplift of manufacturing in, say, 1960, when goods production employed 18 million Americans out of a workforce of 68 million. This, too, is in keeping with the later stages of previous leading world economic powers. Finance distributes its concentrated profits to a much smaller slice of the population. Although any estimate must be subjective, some 30 to 40% of the manufacturing workers during the 1960s, unionized, high-wage men for the most part, would have belonged to that era's emerging blue-collar middle class. At the top of the pyramid, some 50 to 100,000 or so senior manufacturing executives had compensation enough to put them in that era's top 1% income group. Yet in the manufacturing companies of that era, even chief executive officers made only 25 to 40 times the pay of a median production worker. By contrast, as finance consolidated its hold in the 90s, corporate CEOs made 300 to 500 times the pay of a median employee. Compared with the relative egalitarianism of manufacturing in the Eisenhower and Kennedy years, the smaller workforce of the contemporary financial services industry includes a much larger ratio of high earners, probably 8 to 10 times as many per thousand, whose $500,000 or over incomes put them in the top 1% nationally. The shrinking blue-collar middle class is the glaring casualty of the new regime. But a considerable percentage, with more to come, of yesteryear's white-collar employees, secretaries, clerks, statisticians, and telephone operators, also face losing jobs to computers or high school graduates in Hyderabad or Malaysia.